Why does one product or online video become wildly popular while others never get off the ground? Well, that's the question that Jonah Berger asks and answers in his entertaining book called Contagious, Why Things Catch On, from Simon & Schuster. Mr. Berger is the James G. Campbell Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was on our show in March. Because listeners responded with a lot of comments, we decided to re-air that conversation for you today. I began by asking him, what got you thinking about these questions of why one product becomes more successful than another? Were you looking at something that had flopped and wondering why?
I think we see examples of this all the time in our lives, whether it's an online video that goes viral or a particular product. You know, Greek yogurt is one thing that's hot right now. But we don't know too much about why they become popular. And so I've really devoted my career research-wise to studying these sort of issues.
Well, I remember in the 60s, there was a low-calorie beer that flopped. And then a few years later, light beers became the rage.
Yeah.
Was it just a matter of bad timing or
so some
bad
of these things
marketing?
Are timing. Yeah, so I mean, we've looked at cultural evolution, so what becomes popular next and how what's popular now affects that. With baby names, for example, if Karen is popular now, we found that other K names are more likely to become popular in the future. And so sometimes the idea or the product is right, it's just not the right time.
Well, also, this time is particularly fortuitous, isn't it? Because of Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and just the speed with which people can learn about something.
The internet and social media in particular has definitely made it easier to share things with others. But I think you'd be surprised how little word of mouth is actually online. Most of it's actually offline, face-to-face communication. Actually, only 7% of what we talk about and share is online. Most of it's in an offline context, having lunch with our colleagues at work or talking with our family at home in the evening. And so the internet's made it faster and easier to share things. But many things we share are actually in offline context.
Your book has been compared to Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point, which came out in 2000. He wrote that a few influential people in a community cause particular ideas to become popular, but you say you disagree with him on that.
Yeah, it's a very intuitive idea. It's a compelling idea, but there's actually no data to suggest really that certain people are repeatedly more influential than others.
Even though they endorse something?
Well, they endorse some things that succeed, but they also endorse a lot of things that fail. To use someone else's analogy, it's like saying, hey, there's a corner restaurant, and I was the first customer, and now it's popular, so I must be the reason that it is popular. Just because I went there first doesn't mean I'm the reason it became popular. And so rather than focusing on the messenger, and this book focuses a lot on the message, how we can design products or ideas to make them more talkable or shareable, regardless if someone has 10 friends or they have 10,000 friends.
So you're thinking more in terms of marketing than sociology?
Both, really. So this book is really a psychology book, understanding why we share things. So how emotions, for example, drive us to pass things on, or how triggers in the environment shape what we share.
You open the book with an example of successful marketing, a rather odd example, a new steakhouse in Philadelphia that put up a $100 cheesesteak on the menu.
Yeah, I think it's a great example for a number of reasons. First, it's just remarkable. I mean, you hear about a $100 cheesesteak and you want to know, well, why is it $100? Today I was at the restaurant in the hotel and there was a $1,000 omelet. I was like, $1,000 omelet? You want to find out more. It's definitely remarkable. But beyond that, it's a great example for Philadelphia in particular, because if you live in Philly, you think a lot about cheesesteaks, and that story then comes to mind. The cheesesteaks act as a trigger for the story about the $100 cheesesteak, making it more top of mind and making you more likely to share it.
I'm going to forget about what makes an omelet worth $1,000. What makes a cheesesteak worth $100?
So it's got everything you might like or might be over the top. It's got Kobe beef. It has lobster. And it has truffles. It comes with a little bottle of champagne. It's really an extremely decadent experience. But if you had one, you just have to share.
But because it's so expensive, people order it and then break it, cut it up into little pieces?
They do. I mean, they share it with their friends. But it's also a great case where having eaten this makes you look good. And talking about it and sharing with others makes you look special and in the know.
Because you can buy a small bottle of champagne and get a $5 cheesesteak.
You could definitely get a $5 cheesesteak. They're quite good.
Your second example is a man who invented a new blender but didn't sell many of them until he posted videos on the internet.
Yeah, so Willett Blend is a quintessential example that I think many of your listeners are probably familiar with. It's a company called BlendTech. Sales weren't really going anywhere, and then they started posting videos of blending all sorts of objects. So imagine dropping your iPhone into a blender and pressing the blend button and watching what happens as it breaks down and basically into sand.
That would cost me a lot of money.
They also did it with golf balls and 2x4 pieces of wood. But the point is, it's amazing to see that happen. But it's also really good marketing for the brand.
So what do these two cases have in common?
I think they have a couple of things in common. So first of all, they're definitely remarkable. Sharing this makes you look smart and in the know. They're also quite surprising. We found in our research, we looked at over 7,000 New York Times articles, understanding why articles make the most emailed list. We found that emotions can drive sharing, but certain emotions increase sharing. Others actually decrease sharing.
So negative emotions will decrease the sharing, while positive emotions will increase it?
That's a great question, and that's what you might think. Why would I share things that make me look bad? But it's actually not about positive and negative. There's some negative emotions like anger or anxiety that actually share a lot. And so it's really about how activating or arousing those emotions are. So if we take anger and sadness, for example, they're both negative emotions. Neither feels really good, but anger is an activating negative emotion. When we're angry, we want to yell at someone or throw something at the television. When we're sad, we sort of want to curl up in a ball and eat a bowl of ice cream. And so deactivating emotions like sadness or like contentment, which is positive, decrease sharing. We're activating emotions, whether they're negative like anger or positive like excitement, drive us to share.
So if I were a reporter for the New York Times, I would keep that in mind. I would stay away from contentment and sadness.
Definitely. And we actually have talked a bit with the New York Times about how to design their content to make it more shareable.
My guest is Jonah Berger. He's written a book called Contagious: Why Things Catch On. You write that there are six principles that make products or ideas go viral: social currency, triggers, emotion, public, practical value, and stories, which you add up into the acronym STEPS. Now, we can't get to all of them, but which ones do you see as the most important and the most interesting to talk about?
So I think they're all important. It's a little bit like a recipe. All the ingredients contribute. But I'll pick one example that I like a lot, this idea of public, making things more public. And the very simple idea is we tend to follow others. We tend to look for others for information. So if we're trying to figure out what restaurant to eat at, for example, we see whether it's full. And if we assume, well, lots of people like it, it must be good. But if we can't see what others are doing, we can't imitate it. So if something is more private, like your socks, for example, it's going to be hard for other people to see them and imitate them compared to your shirt.
But then there's a restaurant in the East Village called Please Don't Tell. It's impossible to find the place unless you know where it is, and it's a big success.
Yes, and we talk about that example in the book, and I think that's a great example of this idea of social currency. The fact that it is something that's hard to find out about. You do have to be in the know. It is scarce and exclusive. Makes people feel special if they know about it. It's hidden inside a hot dog restaurant.
It's a bar, really.
Yeah, it's a bar hidden inside a hot dog restaurant. You have to walk through a little phone booth to get there. It's really hidden. But if you find out about that, you look special because you have access to that information.
And you know something that other people don't know.
Exactly. Just like the cars we wear and the clothes we drive, what we talk about affects how other people see us.
And then there are people like me who say, well, if they don't want me, I don't want them. That's why I would never go to a disco where there was a velvet rope and some guy deciding you but not the other person.
That's a little bit like Yogi Berra's quote. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be a part of a club that would have me as a member.
So things might help get certain people interested and lose others.
You know, I think these principles are psychological principles. They're not particular ones specific to a domain. So I agree what makes you excited, what makes you feel like you have social currency may not be the same as everybody else. But for each of us, there's a domain we care about. And if we feel special in that domain, we want to talk about and share to show we have that information.
One of the things is triggers. And you write that people who vote in a poll site located in a school are more likely to vote in favor of education funding.
Yeah.
Just because they're in a school?
Just because they're in a school. So the idea here is what we see in our environment triggers related stimuli in our mind. So seeing, for example, a school reminds us of things related to children, which might shape our voting behavior.
Well, what happens if the polling place is in a church and you're not religious, but there you are because that's where you have to vote?
Yeah. So I actually consulted on a court case about just this issue a few years ago. And the thing people are concerned of, and we haven't looked at it empirically, but might voting in a church, for example, affect how you vote on stem cell issues or gay marriage? And might it shape behavior in a way that we might not want?
And what did you find?
We didn't look at churches per se, but you could imagine that you're more likely to behave according to church doctrine when you vote in that particular location.
The WNYC website has three lists: most viewed, most commented, and most listened. Sometimes a segment will make one list and not another.
So I think there are definitely things we like to listen to, but we don't like to share with others. So imagine guilty pleasures, for example, right? You may love a teeny bopper music artist, or you may love a type of movie that not everyone else likes. So you like listening to it, but you don't necessarily want to share it with everyone else because it doesn't make you look particularly good.
Well, I'll give you an example. Our show posted Ina Garten's recipe for balsamic roasted Brussels sprouts on our show page back in October, and it's been on the most viewed list for weeks. I mean, ever since October.
Oh, wow.
And we posted other recipes since then, but that's the one that has remained. Now, I thought, is it because of balsamic vinegar? Is it because of Brussels sprouts?
Brussels sprouts have definitely become much more popular lately. They're sort of one of those foods along with bacon and kale that's in the zeitgeist at the moment.
And maybe Ina Garten doesn't hurt. In general, food-related articles, videos, and TV shows tend to be popular. Is that because they have practical value?
Definitely. So one thing we found in our New York Times analysis is food-related articles like restaurant reviews or even movie reviews or other things that have useful information are much more likely to make the most emailed list, in part because people want to help others out. They want to give them content that makes their friends and family's lives better.
In the book, you use stories of successful marketing campaigns to illustrate your points, and your last principle is stories. Why does telling a story get people's attention?
Well, I think we don't like to sound like walking advertisements. Narratives are much more interesting. We follow the details. I was just listening to your last segment with Clive Davis, and as he tells the story, everyone sort of leans in to hear what's going to happen to the main character. How's the story going to end? Once you have their attention, you've kept their attention. And so I think it's a great way to engage with other people and encourage them to follow along.
And I'm sure people want to hear his stories because he's known so many important people, but there's a thin line between being a name dropper and being a guy who tells good stories.
Oh, definitely. And I think we all have friends who tell good stories. Part of what this book is about is, even if you're not a great storyteller, how you can become a better one.
One of the examples of clever marketing techniques is the rule of 100. How does that work?
So very simply, it's part of the idea of practical value. And the notion there is the same deal can seem like a better or worse deal depending on how it's framed. So imagine a $20 T-shirt, for example. You could take $5 off the T-shirt or 25% off. That would be the same amount of money. The person would still pay $15 for the shirt. But 25% off seems like a better deal than $5 off. That said, if you flip it to something more than $100, let's say a $2,000 laptop, 25% off there is $500 off. But there the money, $500, seems better than the percentage, 25. And so it's how you frame the same discount can make that discount seem larger or smaller.
Do you think anyone can be successful by applying these ideas if they were opening a new business?
So what I think is great about this book is it helps everybody from big companies and for-profits to small companies and nonprofits. You don't have to have a big advertising budget to help get your product to catch on. You have to understand why people share information from everything from the corner yoga shop to the local coffee shop.
And it also makes some people suspicious about being manipulated.
Definitely. I think, though, our friends are not out to manipulate us, right? Our friends are out to give us useful information. If a product is not good, they'll tell us that.
Well, one of the more fascinating things you write about is how people in need of a kidney transplant will refuse a kidney if they think a lot of other people have passed on it. If you need a kidney, don't you just need a kidney?
You do, but again, that idea of using others as information, public, you know, if we think that a kidney's not good because lots of other people have turned it down.
How would anybody know?
Well, if you're on a list, and so if you're on 300 on the list, if it gets to you, you know it's been through 299 people who've turned it down first, right? And so the fact that they turned it down makes you assume it's not as good and make you turn it down as well.
This book has a bright orange cover. Is that because your research has found that it's the cover that most likely will attract book buyers?
We wanted to make the cover very public. So when people are reading it on the subway or the bus or on the plane, it's easy to see other people doing it, which might encourage people to ask about it or find out about it themselves.
So it's calling attention to yourself is important as long as you do it in a way that doesn't annoy people.
Yes.
Are you going to follow up on this? I've always wanted to know why certain songs become hits when they sound exactly like the other song that I heard.
Yeah, so we actually did a paper on this recently, not using song data, but using baby names data. But we've done over 25 papers in this space. So over a decade's worth of research on why things catch on.
And you said K names did well, but J names also. We have Jennifer and Jonah and Joshua and Jacob. And
what our research shows is names that are similar sounding to existing names, but not too similar, are more likely to become popular next. And even after a hurricane, for example, so after Hurricane Katrina, K names jumped up by 9% because people have heard the sound K more frequently in the name Katrina, and it makes similar sounding names sound better.
Well, I'm not sure I want to name my kid after a hurricane.
It's not after the hurricane, it's just similar.
Contagious, Why Things Catch On, is Jonah Berger's latest book. He is a James G. Campbell Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's published dozens of articles in academic journals, and now this book is something we all can understand. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.